Thank you so much, Henry. Our next speaker, Jeff Hummel, is associate professor at Golden Gate University, where he teaches both economics and history. In addition to his book, Emancipating Slaves, Enslaving Free Men, Jeff is also the author of the scripts for an audio tape series, actually two series, for Knowledge Products, the first being The Constitution that was narrated by Walter Cronkite, and the second was a series of tapes called The American Wars, narrated by George C. Scott, the late George C. Scott. His articles have appeared in the Texas Law Review, International Philosophical Quarterly, The Independent Review, and other publications. He's also a contributor to the Encyclopedia of American Business History and Biography. He's also a contributor to one of the Independent Institute's books, edited by Robert Higgs, called Arms, Politics, and the Economy. Many of you may also be interested to know that Jeff was a tank platoon leader in the U.S. Army. He received his undergraduate degree from Grove City College and did his graduate work at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm very pleased to introduce Jeff Hummel.
Thank you, David. That's a nice introduction, and I want to thank you all for coming. It's a real honor for me to be up here with Henry Mayer, because I'm, as some of you already know, I'm a great admirer of his book, and I hope you all take advantage of picking up a copy as soon as you've also bought a copy of mine. It is, I think, the definitive biography of William Lloyd Garrison. Let me talk a little bit about my book. It's Emancipating Slaves, Enslaving Free Men is a general history of the Civil War. It covers all aspects of the war, the outbreak, the military, political, economic dimensions, the consequences of the war, and it does so in a way that's accessible to a general audience. So you all know Christmas is coming up. But in the process of offering a narrative history, I have about between a dozen and half a dozen provocative theses in which I disagree with prevailing views. And suffering from the occupational hazard of all teachers, which is loving to hear myself talk, I could give you a two-hour presentation on each one of those provocative arguments. But I'm going to try to summarize just the two that I consider to be the most salient, and then we'll leave all the other issues for the question and answer. One of the most important arguments I make is, of course, captured in the title. Emancipating Slaves, Enslaving Free Men. And some of you will be surprised to learn that that actually comes from Abraham Lincoln himself. When Lincoln was a very young man in 1838 in Springfield, he was speaking before the Lyceum, and he was giving a talk on the dangers of a future Napoleon who might seize the United States government and overthrow the Constitution. And in the course of that warning, Lincoln said, "Towering genius thirsts and burns for distinction, and if possible will have it, whether at the expense of emancipating slaves or enslaving free men." I'm not the first to point out how chillingly self-referential that quotation is, right down to the towering genius part, because of course Lincoln was both towering and a genius. And one of the themes of my book is the senses in which Lincoln brought about the enslavement of free men. There's the obvious sense that in the process of emancipating slaves, he crushed the aspirations of white Southerners for self-determination. I'm actually more concerned about the political enslavement of Northerners, at least in a metaphorical sense. And what I have in mind here was most deftly summarized by a 20th century American, Randolph Bourne. Some of you have heard his famous maxim, "War is the health of the state," that he put into an essay that he wrote at the time of World War I as he was looking around at the excesses of the Wilson administration. And what he meant by that, "war is the health of the state," is that during wars, during nearly all wars, government increases in power, scope, size, and intrusiveness in order to fight the war. So there's a wartime surge in government power, and also there seems to be this post-war ratchet effect where after the war is over, there's demobilization. Some of the wartime taxes may be repealed, conscription may be lifted, civil liberties may not be as severely circumscribed, but government never seems to go back to its pre-war levels. So part of the book is to argue, demonstrate both this wartime surge in government power that resulted from the Civil War and the post-war ratchet effect. Moreover, I argue that these two features, the surge and the post-war ratchet effect, are true of all wars, but I argue that the Civil War was unique, that it had something that was made it different from other American wars, in that I think it represents the real turning point in American history. Now, by turning point, what I mean to say is turning point with respect to the power of government. I think it's commonly believed that Americans at one time enjoyed greater freedom from government than any other people on the face of the earth. And whether we think that's a desirable outcome or not, we have to all admit that a lot has changed in terms of government involvement in our lives. And my overarching view of American history is that prior to the Civil War, American history was dominated by four ideological movements. Each of these ideological movements was unique. Each of them had their own idiosyncrasies. But each of them were manifestations of the worldwide movement towards classical liberalism. Each of them were hostile to coercive power, and they steadily eroded the authority of government in the pre-war, pre-Civil War period. So that if you look at the long-term trend, despite wars and their ratchets, the long-term trend is for government to get less and less powerful as the Civil War approaches. And the four movements that I have in mind are, first of all, the radical Republican movement that spearheaded the American Revolution and the ideology of which is captured in the Declaration of Independence. That was followed by the Jeffersonian movement. I see the Jacksonian movement as also a thrust in that direction, and ironically, the abolitionist movement that arose about the same time. And the great tragedy of American history, in my opinion, is that at the very moment, the Civil War, when you get the elimination of the last great coercive blight on the American landscape, black chattel slavery, and that's an accomplishment that, in my opinion, cannot be overestimated in significance. At that very moment, the American polity begins marching in the opposite direction. And so my argument is that the Civil War represents the simultaneous culmination and repudiation of the principles of the American Revolution. Given all of that, see, this is the downside of the Civil War, the cost of the Civil War. Given all of that, and even given that emancipation was only an unintended consequence of the Civil War, in my opinion, slavery was such an evil and vile institution that if that was what was necessary to get rid of slavery, it was worth it. Okay, that's my personal moral opinion. But of course, the premise there is, was the Civil War necessary? And another part of the book is designed to argue that in fact the war is not necessary to eliminate slavery. It's not the only way to have brought about abolition. One of the propositions I'm making is that letting the Lower South go in peace was still a viable anti-slavery option when Lincoln took the oath of office in front of the unfinished Capitol Dome on that brisk, sunny March of 1861. In other words, if Lincoln and the Republican Party had been primarily interested in getting rid of slavery, there were an alternative set of policies that they could have implemented which would have brought down slavery nearly as rapidly and at a much lower cost. And even if the Republican Party was not interested primarily in getting rid of slavery, that the worldwide momentum behind abolitionism was such that slavery, even in that case, would still have not survived into the 20th century. And it's actually William Lloyd Garrison and the other radical abolitionists who clued me in to this proposition, because along with all of their other radical positions about being in favor of immediate emancipation without compensation to slaveholders and full political rights for all blacks, the abolitionists, or Garrison and the most radical abolitionists, were all advocates of disunion. The slogan, "No union with slaveholders," graced the liberators' masthead for years. And this was not unique to Garrison. Almost all the most of the radical abolitionists embraced this position at one time or another, including the free black leader Frederick Douglass. Historians, I think, have not confronted this aspect of Garrison and the other, and the early abolitionists in full force. They have a tendency to chalk it up to kind of a naive and ineffectual moral perfectionism on the part of Garrison. And I, in contrast, argue in the book that it was a tactic that exhibited considerable sophistication, that it represented a practical way to bring down the peculiar institution. And I won't give the argument in detail, but basically, it hinges on slavery's enforcement costs. I am arguing that slavery was profitable to slaveholders. There's no doubt about that. But that slavery was a system that was economically inefficient. How can something be both profitable and inefficient? Well, think of piracy, right? Piracy is profitable to pirates, but inefficient for the economy overall. And the elimination of piracy on the high seas was a huge economic boon. Monopoly, to the extent that it results from government barriers to entry, is profitable for the monopolists, but generates economic inefficiencies. My argument is that slavery, similarly, generated economic inefficiencies, and that its survival therefore depended on a whole range of subsidies from government at all levels. And in particular, the most important subsidy involved subsidizing slavery's enforcement costs. My study of slavery in the United States and elsewhere has led me to the conclusion that the Achilles heel of all slave systems has been the runaway slave. You know, how much slaves were very, very valuable assets to slaveholders, right? Slavery is a form of theft where the slaveholder is stealing the income generated by the slave, and the price of the slave represented, to use economic jargon, represents the discounted present value of that future stolen income stream. And in that sense, slave pricing was similar to the pricing of other assets in the economy, how much are you going to be willing to pay for shares of Microsoft stock if a good number of them can get up and walk away? And everywhere that slaves could easily run away, the slave system was compromised. That's why the fugitive slave clause was in the Constitution. The fugitive slave clause that required the return of runaway slaves. It was right in the Constitution. It's the reason the Underground Railroad ended in Canada rather than Pennsylvania. It was one way, not the only way, but perhaps the most crucial way in which the federal government subsidized the slave system. And part of Garrison's strategy was to try to have the North break its connection with the South so that it could become a haven for runaway slaves. Nobody felt that that would automatically eliminate slavery in South Carolina, but there was a feeling that it would bring about a domino effect, that it would compromise slavery in the northern tier of slave states, where already the proportion of slaves to the total population was declining, and that would eventually bring about abolition in the Deep South. There are cases where the runaway slaves are responsible for bringing down a slave system, the most notorious being Brazil. After the Civil War, there were still two major slave economies within the New World. One was Cuba and the other was Brazil. Brazil had a slave system very similar to that of the United States. And the abolitionist movement was strong enough that in Brazil passed a gradual emancipation law in the 1870s, but it was a law that freed no living slaves. What it said was that any slave born after passage of the law would be free upon reaching his or her 21st birthday. It was written that way to protect, of course, the assets of slaveholders. But what happened was before that law it would have taken a generation to have been effective, waiting that long, the northeastern state of Ceará in Brazil abolished slavery and became a haven for runaway slaves. Now, Brazil also had a fugitive slave law, but it was unenforceable. And the very domino effect that could have occurred in the United States did occur in Brazil, so that by 1888, the value of slaves in the plantation regions of Brazil had fallen so low that slaveholders themselves went along with immediate uncompensated emancipation because they were afraid if they held out any longer, they would lose their land. How long is it from 1884 to 1888? 4 years. How long is the Civil War? 4 years. Now, of course, there are differences, but nonetheless, I think it's an example that bears close examination. Because of the Fugitive Slave Clause and these other subsidies to slavery, I think that slavery was in essence an institution that depended on political protection for survival, and that if you eliminated the political protection, eventually slavery would come down. So to sort of summarize the position where I place my book in terms of the huge, vast literature that David was mentioning on the Civil War, you have very, very many what I would call nationalistic accounts of the Civil War. Accounts that are pro-Union, assume that breaking up the Union would have been a catastrophe, and then also use the additional justification for suppressing Southern secession, that it was the only way to get rid of slavery. Now, there is an underground literature that has opposed this nationalistic perspective on the Civil War. You can call it a neo-Confederate literature. Some books have recently come out in that tradition. This is a tradition that is pro-secession, but in the process of being pro-secession, it ends up being blasé and apologetic about not just black slavery, but also a lot of the excesses of the Confederacy. My argument is sort of uniquely positioned. In other words, what I'm saying is that you can be simultaneously consistently pro-secession and rabidly anti-slavery, just as William Lloyd Garrison was at one time. So thank you very much, and now let's do some questions.